nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Did everyone, would anyone not have any problem with me kind of reviewing this section? Because it got a little complicated, I think, right? Just kind of all the ways that things go together in terms of the intermediate lens talking with the back focal plane and the like. So let me just go ahead and remind everyone how that finished off and then move on from there. So again, we were talking about how when we're using the primary objective lens, what we're using is a convex lens. We're trying to take a picture of some object. And we are going to get a diffraction pattern on the back focal plane and an image, either magnified, usually a magnified image on the back, on the conjugate image plane. And again, the reason this is where the diffraction pattern forms is because diffraction yields electrons that are all coming off at the same angle. That's essentially what the sample is doing, is it's basically grading the electron wave as it comes in and giving particular angles to which you have constructive reinforcement. And since you have particular angles, it's the parallel rays that get focused together at the back focal plane, and thus it's the diffraction, common diffracted rays that form spots in the back focal plane. So if we want to look at the diffraction, what we want to do is take an image of this plane. If we want to take an image of the sample, the next lens down wants to focus here. And so really what we were finishing off with is we're saying, look, if you have a condition where you're trying to image your sample, what you do is you take the primary objective lens. Again, these diagrams are all skewed. There's nothing anywhere near this amount of angle going on. The angles we're using are very, very narrow, right? And I've got this extended to make it more easy to see. But again, you have the formation of the diffraction pattern in the back focal plane, the image in the conjugate image plane. And then if you want to form an image, what you do is you choose where the intermediate looks to be at the conjugate image plane. And if you follow these ray paths down, what you'll find is that you get the same image formed on the other side of this projector lens. Of course, in the real microscope, there's a combination of a total of three intermediate lenses in a projector lens, a total of four lenses in most microscopes these days. But again, the idea is that you just choose the strength of the intermediate to have this become the object plane of this lens, thereby taking an image of the sample all the way down. If instead you want to take a picture of the diffraction pattern, you weaken the intermediate lens so it looks further up the microscope, and there it's looking at the location of the back focal plane, and then what gets projected down through the rest of the column is the diffraction pattern. Okay? Now, interestingly, right, you'll see that the image still exists, it's just not what we're focusing on. Okay? Similarly, when we go back and look at imaging, the diffraction pattern still exists, it's just not what we're focusing on with the intermediate. And so anytime you have an image, there is embedded in that image information from the diffraction events, right? And that's, again, crucial to the use of the microscope, because what we can do is, if we want, we can choose to image with particular diffracted rays to get particular types of information, and I'll show that next. So again, the real choice we make is we make a choice between using the intermediate to look at the image plane or the back focal plane of the primary objective imaging lens, and that gives us either the diffraction pattern or a image of the original sample, okay? So that's the key point. And again, to do this, it's relatively simple. The lens programs for the microscope are all set up so that when you hit a button called magnification in the JOL world, or when you hit a button called zoom in the Philips world, then you get a picture that is a magnification of the image. If you hit diffraction, you instead get a diffraction pattern, and all the lenses readjust. Those of you all that were in lab on Thursday got a chance to see that, because we've been further along through the lectures, and you saw right how we switched from magnification to diffraction, just led to whole scale changes in the intermediate lens. And we'll do that for the rest of you next week in lab, okay? Okay, so that's where we finished up. Now, one thing that's interesting, right, is I did have a discussion of depth of field and depth of focus when talking about lenses, and I guess we can talk about it here. Sometimes I do when I give these lectures, sometimes I don't. But again, the reason that all this works out well is that the depth of focus in particular, which is the amount of the image basically it's the breadth over which the image is in focus on the other side of the lens, depends on the magnification squared. And we talked about how when you get to very large scale numbers of magnification, you have large depths of focus. But when we're dealing with this situation here, we don't have that much magnification between just coming out of this single objective lens. And what that means is there's only some depth to the depth of focus here in the back focal plane and here in the image plane. And what that means is it's possible to discriminate between these two locations with the intermediate lens. What happens as we go further down the column, the magnification increases, and so the amount of the setting for these different lenses, basically all you're doing is having fixed places because the depth of focus gets large enough that for either magnification or for diffraction, a single value of that setting is going to allow all the rest of the lenses to look in the correct place to get a focused image from the things out on the other side. And so what's kind of neat about this is the fact that the depth of focus is relatively small in the objective lens case because the magnification is relatively small, means that you can use this first intermediate lens to discriminate between the image and the diffraction pattern. And that's what makes this all very useful. And then what's nice about it is by the time you start to magnify more significantly, you don't have to align so carefully all the different lenses because the depth of focus gets large enough that they're always looking in the right place. Okay? And that makes things a whole heck of a lot easier. When you do align perfectly to look at the diffraction pattern or the image using the intermediate, there is one single step you can do to focus this more finely to make sure that you're in the right spot. Okay? But again, it's really easy as a result. The other thing, too, to look at is as we look at this, you have here a magnification number, and really the question is how do these things all scale? And it turns out that with that small amount of magnification coming out of the objective lens, there's a very reasonable a length over which this intermediate lens has to look. Okay, so the final thing to do is to ask ourselves, well, how do we go through and understand diffraction from regions of the sample that we want? It could be that if you're looking at, say, an aluminum alloy and you have a grain boundary, you're looking at two grains, you may be interested in the precipitate structure on one side of that grain and not the other, right? So you want to be able to do a couple of things to choose the area from which you get diffraction. One way to do it, of course, is to just illuminate that area because then you'll only have diffraction of electrons in the area that's illuminated. Now, the problem with that, in some of the microscopes, if you don't have the ability to do plane parallel illumination, if you only have two condenser lenses, right, then you necessarily will have some convergence angle. And so those spots will broaden out into breadth of disks because you have some convergence angle in, and then you'll have some convergence angle out the other side. So instead, what we do to do diffraction is we use what's called a selected area diffraction aperture. And what it does is it sits in the image plane of, actually, it usually sits in the image plane of the first intermediate lens, but for the ease of diagramming this, I've shown it here in the image plane of the back of the main objective lens. But what it does is it's, again, just an aperture. It's a hole in a piece of metal, and that hole eliminates some rays from showing up. And if we go backwards, right, we see that it basically defines the area from which we get information out of our sample. Okay? So although we're illuminating a larger area, as we go past the selected area diffraction pattern, no information from that larger area comes into play. And so what this lets us do is it lets us choose the area from which we get diffraction while maintaining a plane parallel illumination. So in the course of using the machine, we'll set the beam up, we'll spread it pretty broadly so that we have relatively plain parallel illumination. And the way that we select the diffraction area is we pop in this aperture at the the conjugate image plane location, and that just chooses the area from which we're getting the diffraction pattern information. Okay? So there's other rays that could be coming out of the sample, right? But we don't get a chance to see them as we magnify further down the microscope column. So that's another key aspect in doing diffraction and imaging, is the fact that we can choose the area from which we are getting the diffraction information. And again, that makes it all very useful. That is then used usually in combination with careful imaging, where what you do is you choose particular types of diffraction information in the image. If you take an image, a low magnification image, that has information from the bright from the direct beam, the ones that's unscattered to first order, as well as ones that's diffracted, then you get kind of an overlap of too many bits of information, and it gets hard to understand what's going on. Now, we'll clarify what I mean by that further, but to first order, what you really want to think about is you want to say, hey, if I want to take a picture of something, really what I'm interested in doing is finding out how the sample is having the location of different types of crystalline structure, for example, within it. And so we use the diffraction pattern to quantify and understand what the types of materials are. The diffraction pattern tells us the crystal structure. And then what we can do is we can selectively image different beams to help deconvolute where things are in that image in terms of crystal structure. So if we have a sample here, right, and we pop in a pair of reflecting planes, some crystallographic planes that are at just the right angle to satisfy Bragg's law, then what we'll get on the other side is a diffracted beam, okay? If these things match the appropriate wavelength of the electron, there's the appropriate d spacing between the planes, you will get diffraction to particular angles as defined by Bragg's law. And so the output of the sample then is some beam that comes out without scattering to first order, and then another beam that may come out to a particular angle as defined by the combination of lambda and the d spacing between the planes that are there. And so what we'll do also is we'll use an objective aperture. This aperture sits in the back focal plane, and what it lets us do is choose the electrons we image with by their scattering characteristics, by their diffraction characteristics in particular. And so we can either choose to use the direct beam to image, or if we would like, we can choose to use one of the diffracted beams. And the reason to do this is if we look at the direct beam or we look at the diffracted beam, and if there's regions of our sample that have unusual diffraction compared to the primary parts of the sample, these regions will show up preferentially in these types of images. They will scatter differently than the perfect crystalline regions and give you contrast. And so what we're going to do in using the microscope is we'll use an additional aperture that sits in the back focal plane that collects either the direct beam or the diffracted beam to do imaging. And in fact, we will often tilt the illumination of the sample if we want to collect one of the diffracted beams so that it is put along the optic axis, and then this diffracted beam is now on the optic axis, has lower aberrations, and forms a better image. So again, when using the microscope, what we will do is either image with unscattered electrons, that's what's called a bright field image, or we will usually tilt the illumination to a particular angle as defined by a particular Bragg reflection in the crystal, and then we'll image with the diffracted beams on the other side. So you'll remember in the first lecture that I gave, we had examples of diffraction contrast images, right? You'll remember that we were talking about things that you can do with the microscope. One of the things you can do is image defects, right? And these, for example, were dislocations. And what the dislocations are linear defects. They're atomic, single atomic planes that are misregistered, essentially, with respect to the primary crystal. And so they have a locally different diffraction. If we looked, right, we saw that around those planes, there's some local deviation from the perfect diffraction conditions. And so what you're seeing is an area that's scattering differently than the rest of it. And in the microscope, the way that we put that together is we basically illuminate the sample. We get either a direct beam or a diffracted beam to be used as our image. In the case of these ones here, these are bright field images. We're using the direct scattered electrons and seeing deviations from the presence of those defects scatter to different angles coming about from that, and it pumps intensity away from that direct beam. If we want to image in the so-called dark field mode, here what you're doing is you're setting up the condition of the microscope to have those defects preferentially scatter into one of the diffracted beams. And again, that's what you're seeing is the areas that are preferentially scattering into a particular thing showing up as white, all right? And so the difference between bright field and dark field is just whether you're using the direct beam or you're using these particular diffractive beams. And again, in the microscope, the way that that's actualized is it's actualized through the use of an objective aperture, which lets you choose which portion of the sample, which portion of the diffraction information is being used to form the image, okay? So again, that's a lot of information. You'll hear it again when we talk about diffraction in a full lecture, but the reason to remind you of it now is because today we're talking about how the microscope works, and one of the things we do in the microscope is we use the objective aperture to select different beams for imaging. And we also use the selected area aperture to select different regions, right, for diffraction. And the thing is by having these choices between which beams we image with, right, what it lets us do is it lets us return to this diagram that we showed earlier where we have, right, the overall scheme where we have information in the back focal plane, information in the image plane. And I said, right, that all the stuff here in the image has built within it diffraction information. And by using these apertures at the location of the back focal plane for imaging, using these apertures, the selected area aperture, for choosing the diffraction information, it lets us parse out where different things are, right? So we now have a sample. We take a diffraction pattern. We determine that it's aluminum, and it has aluminum copper precipitates of a particular structure in there. What we can do is we can align the crystal so that we have diffraction occurring. We can tilt the beam so that the diffraction from one of those crystallites is coming along the optic axis, choose that beam to image, and then everywhere where you have those aluminum copper precipitates, that's where you're going to have bright in the image. Okay? So that allows you to deconvolute by crystal information where things are. All right? And that's really very powerful because, again, all that we want to know in terms of the structure has to do with its crystal structure and the location of different crystal structures within the overall composite material. Okay? And that's really the power of it. There is no other technique that has this ability. You can use x-rays to do this and call it x-ray topography. Right, but the problem with X-ray topography, it's a powerful technique if your defects are spread far apart. Okay, but if you want to do this at a very fine scale, the TEM is it. It's the only technique that allows you to get this combination of information from the diffraction and the imaging, and that's really the power of this technique. One of the many powers, but one of the primary ones. Okay, so again, in the use of the microscope, returning to this Bain diagram, we have a sample. It's diffracting. We're forming a diffraction pattern in the back focal plane. We're forming an image in the image plane of the objective lens. We can choose to take a picture, right, and magnify that. So I'm sorry, that's this one here. Take a picture by magnifying that conjugate image plane down. We can take another picture where we are taking information from the back focal plane and giving the diffraction pattern. Interestingly, right, by the choice of the selected area aperture, we choose the area from which the diffraction is coming. And again, if we want, by putting in this objective aperture in the back focal plane, we choose the types of diffraction information. Okay? And so again, what you can do is go through and redraw those diagrams with this objective aperture in there and see how different rays are eliminated. In fact, what I'd like you all to do is to go to the Blackboard page for this event, and we'll also put it up on the NanoHub site too. I'll give you a homework number one. And that homework number one has you basically redrawing all these diagrams with a couple positions and selections for the apertures and the like, okay? So if you could go and do that. In the case of the MSE 582 people, please do it. In the case of the 640 people, I'll grade it and count it as part of your grade because MSE 582 is just pass-fail, okay? But please do it. It helps because what this will force you to do is watch all these ray diagrams go together, okay? Okay. And again, just with the condenser system, as with the condenser system, if you are trying to understand your microscope, you can always go to the manual and watch all the different lenses as they work. The print gets a little bit small here, but this is magnification mode in the JOL 2000 FX at relatively low magnifications, from a couple thousand up to about, I think, 10,000 there. And as you go to higher and higher magnifications, this is about the maximum magnification on the machine. It's just showing how the different ray diagrams work to magnify that if you want to follow through and catch it. And again, you can see that really as you go and have the highest levels of magnification, you're just collecting different portions of that image and magnifying them further and further. Okay? So that's how the imaging system works in the machine. And again, what it is you have the primary information coming out of the objective lens, the diffraction pattern, and the image, and you use the intermediate lens to choose which of those two things you magnify further down the column. You use the presence of the selected area diffraction aperture to select the area from which you get diffraction, good name, right? You use the objective aperture in the back focal plane as a way to get an image, right, of the different diffracted events. Questions? Okay. That was very repetitive. I said the same thing about 14 different ways. And the reason I did that is because that's the most important thing in all of it, right? So, again, we'll get down on the lab and we'll run through and hit all the buttons and do all these same things, and I'll repeat myself again and again and again. And the idea is that instead of knowing that if I want to take an image, I hit this button and rotate that knob, I want you to be thinking about what you're doing when you switch from magnification to diffraction. What lenses are doing what? Where are you looking? Which aperture would you need to do different types of things? Okay, so forgive the repetitive nature of that, but that's the way I want to do things. Okay, so what we've gone through and done in the discussion of how the instrument goes together is we've talked about the gun, we've talked about the condenser system. Within the condenser system, we've understood how different combinations of lenses work, how you can use two lens combinations. And then moving on into the objective system, we understood how we can choose between getting diffraction information and image information from our sample. Now, in order to do all this, right, we've got a whole bunch of lenses all in a row. And what we need to do is we need to make sure that they're talking to each other, communicating appropriately. We're trying to make sure that the output from each lens is looked at appropriately by the lens below it. Okay? So the fortunate thing, as I mentioned earlier, is that really as far as a given lens is concerned, it only knows one thing, right? Well, it knows several things, but it's only concerned with the output of the previous lens in front of it, right? So it doesn't know that there was 14 condenser lenses up here and you've done all this stuff. It just knows that there's a place to look, right? And so what this lets us do is in the course of the alignment, we can go through and sequentially work our way from the top of the microscope down, starting with the electron gun, making sure that it's centered, that we have good bright emission, it's centered on the optic axis, work our way through the condenser lenses in the same way, work our way through the intermediate of the objective lens, and then down into the intermediate system. So the course of microscope alignment is a sequential step process from the top all the way down to the bottom. Okay? The primary concern when doing this is for each lens, you want to make sure that the beam passes along the optic axis of that lens. Again, you want to do that because the spherical aberration is the primary it's a third-order aberration. It's the primary aberration that we worry about in terms of the degradation of our images. And so we want to make sure that the beam is passing along the center of the lens, thereby minimizing the effects of the spherical aberration. So how do we choose this optic axis? What we do is there's a green screen. I think everyone saw this in the lab. There's a green screen with a dot in the middle of it. And that dot becomes the optic axis. And when we align the microscope, everything with respect to that dot, it really does become the optic axis for all of the lenses, right? So you have to choose somewhere arbitrarily to start with, but once you have that black dot in the center of the screen, you align everything with respect to the black dot, and that's now the real optic axis for each of the lenses, okay? So that's the way that the thing goes together. Really, the only reason to choose the optic axis as the place is, look, you've got to minimize the spherical aberration, and you got to have something to align it with respect to, so you might as well choose the black dot, okay? It's pretty simple. The other thing that we're going to worry about is not only is the beam coming down the optic axis, but if we have used an aperture, is it centered, right? Because if you take an aperture and you have it off of the optic axis, then again, some of the rays will be on one side of the optic axis, there'll be less on the other, you'll get some lack of good focus due to the spherical aberration effects. And additionally, each of these systems has stigmation in them because of the non-uniformity in the lenses that are involved. So for the condenser system, we'll do a single step of condenser stigmation correction. For the objective system, a single step of objective stigmation correction. And for the intermediate system, I'll show you where that is, and you may or may not need to do it depending on how things are. That's one you don't often need to do. Okay? So that's it. Align the beam along the optic axis. Make sure your apertures are centered. Correct the stigmation. And you're done with the microscope alignment. Conceptually, very simple. So, some other ideas or ways to think about this. There's our example microscope, right? Again, lots and lots of lenses. But really, the thing to think about is that when you're dealing with the condenser system, it's really just two primary lenses that you use. Often, the third condenser lens in our microscope, the 2000FX, is just for additional convergence. So really, we're just worrying about these two primary lenses. And the deal is that what we're trying to do is make sure that we have a good picture of our filament. And the filament is essentially the object for this system that is magnified or demagnified down onto the sample. So we're going to go through and take a look at the filament. We did that in the first lab. We're going to make sure that we have emission coming off of the filament, that we have the filament centered on the optic axis, that the result of that gives a nice round beam, and that if we happen to want to use one of the apertures, that it's centered. So again, we don't introduce any additional problems. And so really, for the next lab, I'm going to have everyone go through and align the condenser system from the gun downwards. And the whole point is we don't even need a sample in. We won't even put a sample into the machine, because all you're trying to do is take the object being the filament and make sure that you can get a good magnification, demagnification of the filament down on the green screen. Okay? And that makes sense, right? Because it's just like using an optical microscope. You're going to choose to have, all you're trying to do is you're just trying to make sure that you have some electrons provided where you want them on the sample for doing the imaging. Okay? Okay. In the objective lens, for this, we're going to go through on the 2000FX, and we will fix the eccentric position. We'll find the optimum position of the sample, right? The one where we get the minimum translation when we tilt. And then after that, we'll go through and fix the objective lens focus, and then everything else is going to key on that, because the objective lens focus defines the location of the diffraction pattern and the conjugate image, right? The objective focus determines the location of the back focal plane and the conjugate image plane, and thus when we align everything thereafter, it's going to be with respect to those two new or those two fixed places that are determined by the sample. Again, when you move on to a more modern microscope that has a preferred objective lens current, you do it the other way around. You set the objective lens current and bring your sample to that position. It just depends on the microscope. But again, the whole idea is to fix a place for the objective lens current and move from there. Okay? So for alignment, there's a series of steps. There's our mythical optic axis as represented by the black dot on the green screen. Okay? So the first thing that we want to do is we want to make sure that our electrons are centered coming off of the gun, right? We want to make sure that we're getting preferential emission from the very tip of the filament. In the case of the tungsten filament, it's from the very tip of that rounded hairpin shape. In the case of the Lab 6, it's from where the four sides of the crystal meet. We want to make sure that the emission comes off of the tip for several reasons. That's where it's brightest. That's where it wears properly and we get the most out of our filament. The thing that we do is we use the gun deflector coils. It's a combination of coils. It has two separate coils that talk to each other to make sure that we can look at the filament right along the center. So the first one that we'll do is we'll do the gun tilt, okay? And the idea there is that we're virtually tilting the beam so that we have it straight up and down and the electrons are coming off of the tip of that filament. In reality, what we're instead doing is changing the gun deflector settings so that the source that is represented by the tip of that filament is then put is then being looked at appropriately from the next set of optics so that we're basically looking at it, you know, so that it looks right up and down, okay? It's not that we're physically tilting the beam. It's rather that we're using a series of coils to make sure that the output appears as though we're looking right directly on top of that filament. The next one that we're going to do down is we're going to try to align the condenser system. We want to make sure that the beam goes all the way through the condenser system along the center of the optic axis for each of the lenses. The way that we do this is we look at the filament as our object, and we make sure that we have it along the optic axis at the top of the system and at the bottom of the system. And the way that we do that is using a particular operation called a centering operation. I'll show you the ray diagrams later. But the idea is that you want to make sure that it looks like it's on the center with these lenses not looking at the bottom, but rather at the top. In other words, you want to make sure that as the thing is coming through the series of these things, if you go through any large changes in the relative strength of these lenses, the beam stays on the optic axis and doesn't move back and forth. I'll show you all those ray diagrams in a second. So that's the second step, is making sure the beam goes through the center of that system. We're going to stick in an aperture. You'll almost always use a condenser aperture. That's just to choose a nice round shape to the beam. And you'll make sure that that thing is physically centered on the optic axis. And then finally, there's a set of stigmator coils that correct for astigmatism throughout this system. Okay, you don't need to do it for each of the individual lenses. It just adds up. And so you use a single set of stigmators on the other side to make the beam round. Okay. So really, that's lab one. This is lab two. Lab three is to learn how to put the sample at the eucentric position. And then we use what's called a pivot point alignment. And really what that's doing is it's a coarse alignment of these beam deflector and scan coils. What it's doing is it's kind of working to first order couple the output of this system, the condenser system, to the input of the objective system. The final thing that we'll do there to kind of clarify that is we'll do what's called a voltage center. And what that does is it really lines that up perfectly along the objective axis, make sure that coupling is done with a high level of precision. And the end result is the beam is now going through the center of the objective lens. This alignment has tremendous effects on the quality of your image, because if it's poorly aligned, you have the rays coming a little bit off the optic axis, right? And the spherical aberration of the objective lens will then come into play and blur your images, and the next sets of lenses will do nothing more than magnify that blur. Okay? So you got to get it right on the objective lens. You have to learn how to do this voltage center correctly so that you get the best images coming out of the objective lens and magnify the best images thereafter with the intermediate. The final thing that you do is you stigmate the objective lens system. So if this is lab one, the electron gun, lab two, the condenser system, lab three is steps 5, 6, and 7, we do a final separate lab on just the stigmation. And that's because it's difficult for your eyes to understand this. It's a very weird looking thing, and it just takes practice. And by practice, it'll take 10 solid 3-hour sessions on the microscope for you before you just go, oh yeah, nothing to it, okay? The first several times you use the microscope, you spend lots of time working on objective stigmation, just trying to get that right. If you do not get it right, your images are blurred. You will see streaks in your image in one direction, depending on the focus condition you're in, and your images look bad, okay? So it's an important one to get correct, and we will spend a full lab just working on understanding ways to look at stigmation in our images and correct it, okay? So again, philosophy, right? Make sure everything comes down along the optic axis, separate it into a couple systems, the gun, the condenser, the objective. In each case, make sure that the beam comes down through the optic axis of each of these systems. Make sure that if you have apertures in, they're centered. Make sure that you remove the stigmation from all of the systems. And even in the intermediate case, there is an additional projector stigmator at the bottom. So if you want, you can remove the stigmation from the intermediate system as well. And then the final thing is you've got a detector at the bottom that you use to take the pictures. Okay? And that's the next lecture. Okay. So also, everyone, go home and follow through this diagram and the next diagram, because in order to understand alignment, this is probably the most important one. If you have some object of some finite size, right, and you're looking at it with our convex lens, if this thing is on the center of the optic axis, let's follow the rays as we go through and change the magnification of this lens. Let's choose one magnification setting, right? So what do? We form a ray that comes off the tip of that object through the center of the lens and goes forward, right? We can go through and take a parallel ray, focus it to the back focal plane, a parallel ray, focus it to the back focal plane. You could have another ray come down here. But the point is that the object that comes out of this lens on the other side of the image is also centered, right? If this thing has equal breadth on either side of the optic axis, it will have equal breadth on the other side of the lens, okay? If we change the focal length, right, and we redraw the diagrams, choose just a different focus, the only thing that happens is we magnify the image, but consistent is the same amount on either side of the optic axis. Okay? So if this is on the center, all we see with changes in focus is changes in magnification. If this thing is displaced from the center of the optic axis, if we have a little bit more on one side than the other, let's go through the ray diagrams again. Okay? Wham, wham, wham. Go through. And what we've got now is we've got a little bit more on one side of the optic axis in the conjugate image. If we change the focus, watch what happens. We not only magnify, but we take the center point of that image and displace it somewhat. Okay? So what this means is it means the way to figure out whether or not an object is on the center of the optic axis, for example, whether or not your filament is on the optic axis of the condenser system, is to go through and do changes in the focal length of that lens and see if that object merely magnifies or if it shifts from side to side. Okay? So if you start with it in a position and you find that as you change the focal length, it shifts from side to side, then that means what you've done is got an uncentered situation and you need to change the location of this so that we recenter it. And appropriate images will only go through magnification changes and not have their center point shift from side to side. So go home and follow these ray diagrams, maybe trace it yourself, right? And understand this, because all the alignments that we do, not all, but most of the alignments we do, deal with this sort of a thought. Changing the focal length on a lens and seeing whether some object shifts from side to side. In the case of the condenser system, the idea is to take the filament image and use strong changes in the condenser one lens and look and see if the filament moves from side to side. If it does not, it's on the optic axis of the first condenser lens. In the case of the objective, what we do is we use you can use a change in the focal length of the objective lens by changing the current in the lens and looking to see if your image moves from side to side. Another way to do it turns out to be to change the voltage, which changes the wavelength. It's better. We'll explain that. But basically, you can go through and change the focal length of the objective lens, and what that gives you is a way to see whether or not the main object is being, you know, and the electrons are coming along the optic axis of the objective lens system, okay? So that's the idea. And so this is the very, very important step. And again, we'll go through, sit on the microscope and watch this, okay? Any questions on that? Anything not make sense?
Centering happens a couple times, right?
It happens almost all the time when you're using the thing. You just kind of keep recentering things and making sure they're right on top, okay? Usually the way that you, once you start to learn how to align the microscope, I'm not bragging, I'm just saying that it's factual. You know, if you want, I can take that microscope downstairs and align it in 2 minutes, right? You'll find it'll take you an hour and a half or two the first couple times as you think your way through it. But the point is as you get better and better at it, you just find yourself aligning it all the time. It doesn't really, you don't even notice that you're doing it almost. In the case of taking your best images, I always realign the microscope right before taking pictures, just because that way everything's right on spot, okay? So you do this again and again and again, and you just learn where things look right and where they don't. And microscope alignment, you know, it forms the whole activity of these labs. It has this feel of being extremely important, and if things aren't perfectly aligned, then it's awful. That's true. Depending, though, to some extent on the quality of images you seek. So one of the things that you also need to learn as you go forward is how good is good enough, right? If you're taking an image of something at 5,000 times magnification, 5,000 being a very low level of magnification, you can get away with a little sloppiness in the alignment. If you want to take a picture at 500,000, it needs to be spot on, or it's going to look really, really bad, okay? So again, with alignments, you just kind of develop a sense of when to really have it spot on and when to just move forward so you don't waste your time. The goal of the microscope is not to align it, okay? Even though it feels like it in the lab session, right? Because that's all we talk about is microscope alignment. The goal of the microscope is not to align it. The goal of the microscope is to get diffraction information and image information from your sample. Right? So you want to learn how to do the alignment quickly so that you can do the important thing with the microscope, which is take your picture and get your diffraction information. So we emphasize alignment, so you take good patterns, so you take good images. But again, don't get so focused on making sure the alignment's always just spot on. Use the microscope to get the information, and the alignment quality should match the quality of information you need. Okay? Okay. Stigmatism, it's hard to show stigmation. This is an example, again, from the Williams and Carter book that we've been using throughout. Excellent book. The picture of something that's perfectly stigmated, it's not going to show up well in your handouts. You can look at it. It's even better in your book. If something's well stigmated, you see that features look rather round. There's no clear directional streaks in this. When something's astigmatic, you'll note that there's a streak in the direction depending on the focal condition, okay? So what we're going to learn to do is see pictures and look for roundedness in them, right? And what the hell does that mean, roundedness? Well, you just got to develop an eye for it. And I say that's a full laboratory just to show you, and then several more to practice. But you really want to try to avoid streakiness. And I think it's fair to say that if you look at this image, you can see structural detail, even though this is just amorphous carbon, whereas in this one, it just looks kind of blurry, okay? It's harder in the field emission microscope. The high level of coherence in the FEG makes it more difficult to differentiate between what's good and what's not. Fortunately, in the FEGs, what we use is a trick using the CCD camera, and we use something that has to do with a mathematical operation on that image called a fast Fourier transform that helps us. Very few people can correctly stigmate a FEG without that. And in fact, I've only known one in my life. So that's, I guess, the alignment steps, right? We talked about the philosophy. We talked about, you know, putting all these systems together, making sure the beam comes along the optic axis, making sure that we have stigmated and the aperture centered for each of the different systems. And really, that's how the alignment goes together. And I gave you my spiel about how, you know, do it as well as you need to. You know, again, if you're trying to take images that are beautiful, high-resolution images at a million times, you got to get it spot on. If you're taking images at 5,000, don't spend 2 hours taking your alignment. Get it good enough and move on. Save your money. And go from there. Okay, the final things to do, I guess, in this lecture is to talk about a couple of other things that you need to know. The microscope just doesn't show up magically with everything correct. You have to calibrate it. It is an instrument just like any other instrument, and there's a number of calibrations that you have to think about. One of them is the magnification. When someone quotes a magnification, when you take your picture, there's a micron bar that will show up on your picture if you're doing it in the CCD. There's a micron bar that shows up on your film, okay? You should be aware of the fact that that thing can be incorrect by as much as 10%, depending on how you've chosen to set up the microscope versus how the microscope was set up when that calibration was made. In particular, if you want to have that magnification bar be correct, you must use the objective lens focus setting, the same objective lens current that the person who calibrated it was using. So, right, because if you choose a different focus, right, then your back focal plane location changes, your image plane changes, and so even though you've hit the button that says you're at 10,000 times, you're not quite, right? Because you've got a little different focus, your magnification's a little bit different. And so what we do is for every microscope, there's a particular objective lens current that you use to get the best focused images, okay? And to get the best calibrated images. In the case of the one downstairs, it's 7.03/04. It's right when the thing's toggling between 0.03 and 0.04. We use that as the preferred objective lens current, and if you do that, the magnification bar will be pretty much spot on, okay? It can drift a little bit with time, too. So if you are desperately trying to measure something at a very high level of precision, you need to have a standard. There are different types of standards that exist. You can use diffraction gratings for low magnification, microspheres. These are these little things. You just buy them. They are of a given size. You can use direct lattice spacings if you have an atomic resolution image. Needless to say, that is an extremely good way to do it if you have a strain-free crystal, right? If you have a picture of aluminum down the 110, then you have measurements of 2.3 angstrom that are 2.3 something angstroms, you know, 2.34 or whatever it is. You can calibrate things pretty nicely that way. Another one that's very nice is there's a thing that you can buy called this MagicHal standard. I don't have any financial interest in this. I just do think it's really great, okay? It's something you buy, and what it is it's a carefully grown silicon germanium sample that has different layers of silicon and germanium. They show up as different levels of contrast, and it's essentially a ruler that spans from about 1,000 times to 1,000,000 times magnification. It's pretty cool. It's a little pricey, but if you're running a lab someday, right, where you are, you know, being asked questions about the size of something that matter, it's probably not too much to spend, okay? So it's something to think about. It's a pretty cool little thing. And I think you have a picture of it there. You can see it's just a little ruler sample showing the different layers of germanium and silicon. Germanium's heavier. It gives a higher scattering contrast, and it shows up. Okay. All right, so that's again there. If you have an older machine, you also have to worry about the rotation between the diffraction pattern and the image. Again, this rotation shows up because we're using magnetic lenses. And if you have an older machine that does not have that compensated, you need to know that. And again, this depends on the objective lens current that you're using. And so you have to have a calibration done with a particular objective lens current, take a series of images at different magnifications, and see how the diffraction pattern rotates with respect to the sample. Usually what people use is molybdenum trioxide. They have a long axis and a short axis. The long axis aligns with a particular direction in the crystal. When you buy one of these things, you buy it from one of the standard EM supply stores. They give you a nice little sheet on how to do this, right? And again, back when I was a young man on the EM400, this was lab number one, was to do a magnification rotation calibration. But nowadays, you don't have to worry about it so much because it's usually most of the machines have this all corrected, okay? The final thing, too, is that with this, be aware that you can have issues with inversion. Again, on one microscope that I've used, what appeared to be corrected diffraction patterns actually had 180-degree inversion in it. So be cautious if that matters to you. If you're doing discussions of polarities in nonpolar crystals, you need to be even more careful. The final one that we worry about is the camera constant. And this is essentially the magnification of the diffraction pattern, right? If we're using the diffraction pattern to look at different spots, we can measure those spots and correlate those with the Bragg angle and thus despacings, okay? And so again, we need to know the particular length here. It's called the camera length, basically the magnification on the diffraction pattern. And it follows right out of Bragg's law with some simple assumptions, right? Namely that the angles are very small that we're dealing with. They are, right? They're down less than a degree in most cases. And so this is a good assumption. And really what this yields is what we do is we take a picture of a known diffraction pattern, right? Take silicon that you have lying around the lab, measure some distances, correlate those with known D spacings, and what you find out is the magnification of the pattern. Again, normally for the microscopes that you'll use, you'll go to a fixed objective lens current, and the calibration of that diffraction pattern will be known. You'll ask the supervisor of the microscope what the answer is for a fixed objective lens current, and you just follow out from there. It's not a bad exercise to do sometime, though, and again, as we go through and discuss diffraction and detail, all of these things become more obvious. But really all it is just a magnification calibration of the diffraction pattern. Okay? There are other calibrations that you may need. I'll point you to the Williams and Carter book. You can get into that if you need to. I've not found these to be that frequent in my career. You can calibrate the convergence angle for seabed. It's actually not much different than the same for the camera constant calibration. You may want to do accelerating voltage. You have a 200 kV machine, but it's in fact 200.2. Sometimes that makes an effect on convergent beam diffraction patterns. So again, you use known standards there. Focal step, you change the focus. It goes a given number of nanometers in defocus. How do you know if that's right or wrong? Again, there's ways to do that. The ones I really want to point out to you is the magnification calibration. Unless you are careful, that micron bar does not mean too much. Additionally, in my opinion, when I read the literature, if someone gives me a measurement and does not say specifically that they did this with a well-calibrated microscope based on some methodology of calibration, I assume it's not correct because I don't know. Okay? right? I don't know if someone did their job properly. I don't know if they used the correct defocus. So there's always some caution when looking at TEM images in the literature. You don't know, unless someone tells you that they were careful about this, you don't know that they were careful. It also means that if you take some pictures on a microscope here and a pictures on some microscopes there, and they don't match, well, you know, that could be because of differences in calibration. It could be because your samples, you know, these little small spheres you were looking at oxidized and disappeared. You don't know, right? I mean, for example, I have a student right now who walked into my office the other day with a big analysis that he'd done based on differences in the measurements done in Sweden on a microscope or these same samples and done at IBM. And I had to kind of remind him of the fact that that measurement, that this difference he was making, meant nothing to me because I didn't know if they had calibrated this to a level of precision he was talking about, or if he had done that either. I knew he hadn't done it because it's hard to do that. So, you know, it's one of these sort of things. Be careful with magnification calibration. Rotation calibration, less important. And again, diffraction, you need to do this too if you want to measure D spacings and no angles particularly, okay? So we'll see all these things in the lab, and that's where I'll finish up today, okay? That's the end.